Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 16th, 2005. This session, Science and the Bible, Context, Text, and Meaning. Earliest Writings, circa 1000 BCE, presented by Levon Batalden in the Fireside Room. Let's listen in.
So what I'm hoping to do is give just a little bit of information about the worldview of periods of time when the Bible was written. Hi, come on in. Looking from that context, that worldview, when we read passages, then think about what did it mean for those people, and then what does it mean for us today? And the other thing we see when we look at the Bible and think about times that they were written, and we often have the same story told at different times in history, or we have stories that are very similar to stories that were known in other cultures around the Israelites, but they don't just take the story and tell the story in the same way, but they modify it to fit their understanding of God and what God expects of them. And so I think that's the ongoing challenge for us, is to take the stories of the Bible and re-look at them in how we understand the world and make them meaningful for us. And we can't just think about what that meant for an Israelite back in 1000 BCE. But given what it meant to them, how do we make it meaningful for us today? And so I'm inviting you on that journey to look at the Bible in that way. It's certainly not the only way to look at the Bible, but it's just another tool maybe to help us understand a little bit. And the time period we're looking at today is 1000 BCE. But since so much of the early written parts of the Bible are from oral tradition, that oral tradition goes back much further than that. So we'll be looking at some stories from earlier than that that may have had an effect on the worldview of the people of the Bible. All right. This is the same old map you saw yesterday. But today we're actually going to be looking at, if we think about the early Israelites, they started out here in Ur. Oh shoot, wrong button. I never am good at technology here. They started out here in Ur, and made some journey, probably up in this direction and down into, they ended up in Canaan, but they also spent time, Abraham spent time over here in Egypt, and then Joseph came down to Egypt. So the early writings of the Bible are going to have something to do with the people of Samaria, something to do with the people of Egypt, and something to do with the people of Canaan. So we're going to take a little look at those cultures. And assuming that the stories that they tell are have something to do with how they understood how the world worked. And you see there Sumer and Akkad. And Sumer, the Sumerians who came there, and they are, no one knows where they came from. But they brought a civilization to Samaria in maybe as early as 10,000 BCE, but certainly by 6,000 BCE, they had quite a civilization going. The Akkads were Semitic peoples who came down into that area and eventually overpowered the Sumerians, but adapted a lot of their civilization and learned a lot from the Sumerians. So, and the Sumerians seem to have kind of disappeared, but their genes probably didn't. I mean, they're in those people. And that's the, Iraq today. So the rich Tigris-Euphrates River people is Iraq today. So we'll look at that civilization, then Egypt, and then a little bit of the Canaanites, into the land where they came, arrived. Sumerians are, I guess we don't need that anymore. The Sumerians are, at least, I'm not taking into account China or South America, because those are not cultures that probably impacted on the Israelites. So when I say first and that kind of thing, I'm talking about this part of the world. And the Sumerians were, as far as we know, the first people to write anything down. First one to have a written language, and it was cuneiform on clay tablets that they cut wedges, and they had symbols for many different things. And so we have that record. They also had city-states, so they had quite sophisticated political, geopolitical settings, walled cities, and earliest agriculture we trace to that area. Wheat and barley, they certainly grew a lot of barley. Barley is a familiar grain in the Bible. They made beer. Quite a few references to recipes for beer in Sumerian records. They made perfumes, and they made soap. The soap seems to be medicinal rather than just for cleaning purposes, but the Sumerians had purity rituals for cleaning, so you washed your hands before you ate, you washed your hands before you worshipped, which we also see in the Israelite tradition to the purification rituals. Sheep were domesticated in that part of the world. There were 200 words in Sumerian for sheep, a little bit like the Native Americans in Alaska and the words for snow. So sheep had to be very important in their culture. They also had a Sabbath, but the Sabbath was not every seventh day like we think of a Sabbath, but it was on the full moon, and in some places it suggests it might have also been new moon. So you had one, maybe two Sabbaths in a month. And if you want to look up in 2 Kings 4, 3 to 23, excuse me, 2 Kings 4, 23. Anybody have 2 Kings 4:23?
23?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sure. He said, "Why go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath." She said, "It will be all right."
So it's the woman going to Elisha, I think, for help. And so that the Sabbath idea is probably very similar to the Sumerian Sabbath, not the every 7 days. It probably came later. And the Sumerians are what became the culture of Babylonia. So when we talk about Babylonia later, the richness of the Sumerian civilization became the Babylonian civilization. And Iraq today. And you had the Tigris and Euphrates River, where the Sumerian culture developed. And then you go over to Egypt, and you've got the Nile River. And so that's where the another rich culture, about the same time as the Sumerians, actually. But when we think, I think we are more familiar with Egypt than we are with Sumeria. The pyramids and the pharaohs and the mummies. So they had a great, probably had quite a strong understanding of chemistry, the things you put together in order to mummify cats and people and any number of things to prepare for the afterlife. Another aspect of a little sidelight really about the Egyptians is that from about 1680 to 1550, there was the Hyksos dynasty was occurring in Egypt. And that may be a little earlier than when we think Joseph was there, but the Hyksos dynasty were some Semites who came down and overpowered Egypt for a while, and then were overpowered again. But Egypt was not all that happy with having been overrun by the Semites, so the Egyptian history of that period is not very fleshed out. But when we read in the Bible that the new king didn't know Joseph. It may well be that they no longer had any Semitic roots. And so to have a Semite as a high up in the dynasty, or not so much in the dynasty, but as an authority to whom the dynasty would listen, might have been a little more understandable. But that's strictly conjecture. The other thing about the Sumerians and the Egyptians is that they had quite a lot of medical understanding, a lot of ways that they treated diseases. And some of the earliest writings are writings about medicine. And they used plants, they used animals, they used minerals. And so healthcare was important and studied a lot way early in these civilizations. We have actually more records, written records, of Sumerians than we do of Egyptians because of the writing on tablets of clay as opposed to papyrus. Papyrus doesn't have the longevity. So we have some very good information about the Egyptians, but much of it's probably lost. So we have the Sumerians, we have the Egyptians, and then the Canaanites. And the Canaanites were the people living in Palestine when the Israelites came. And they were wealthy traders, so that they had wealth from, even though they were a fairly small area, no great big rivers, the Jordan was there, but much more of a desert setting. But they had a lot of wealth because they were traders. And they had walled cities, mansions, things that you would categorize as mansions are found in archaeological finds, but then a lot of tenements in those cities as well. So and there was the wealthy and the poor. So questions about this little brief overview about these peoples?
Did the Canaanites trade between the Sumerians and the Egyptians?
They may well have. Mm-hmm. They had quite big trade routes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
What about their written records?
Of Canaanites, Ugaritic texts are probably Canaanite texts, but they don't go back quite this far.
Okay, so we don't, like the Egyptians, we don't have quite the history.
Quite the history. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. For things like their medical understanding, and you said like their chemistry, mm-hmm. that they had knowledge of, did they pass that down in written form, or was that more of a taught? Have you have any idea how they trained people in those skills?
I know that I've forgotten that it's a papyrus, though, that is a quite a long list of medical treatments from Egypt. But I think there was a trained group of people, too, that passed it down in that way. So, but it's amazing how many plants, like they'll talk about willow, which is our aspirin, and plants that we still use as some kind of medical treatments that were known back then. So these people had a lot of knowledge. It isn't that their worldview was so narrow or limited. Other questions? Then their gods. All these cultures were very polytheistic. They had many gods and a very hierarchy of gods, so that you had, you know, the more important gods, sun gods, and different gods in different cultures, but different gods for different things. Families had their own gods. Some more important were concerned with the king. Others more nature-oriented, but many, many gods and a hierarchy of them. And that's what was a big challenge for the Israelites, because they were trying to be monotheistic peoples. And the in Egypt, in 1378, there was Akhenaten was the pharaoh, and he attempted to make Egypt monotheistic. And that may be related to the Joseph part of the story, we don't know. But Tutankhamun was his son, and Tutankhamun gave up on monotheism because the people were so unhappy giving up their many gods that protected them in their many ways. And so that became a constant challenge for the Israelites. I don't know if we'll look it up, but in Genesis 31, 22 to 35, if people are interested, is a story of Rachel and her teraphim. And in some translations, it actually says household gods. But Jacob is leaving Laban because he feels he's not being treated quite with quite the respect that he once was. And so Leah and Rachel and the family and the servants are all leaving. And Laban discovers that his household gods are missing. And Rachel has taken the household gods because she doesn't want to leave her gods behind. And and Jacob's not aware of the fact that the household gods have been stolen. So he said, well, you can look anywhere. I don't have your gods. And Rachel puts the gods underneath her seat, on whatever it is she's riding on. And then she says to her father, I'm in the way of women, and no one would touch a menstruating woman. So she hid the gods underneath her body, and no one found the family gods. So these household gods were probably a part of the Canaanite people, as well, or the Israelites as well. And if you can imagine, if you came into Canaan, and there were all these wealthy people, and you were a poor nomad, whatever the gods were doing for these people might be a little attractive. And there are also warnings in Deuteronomy that say, do not worship the sun and the moon. And certainly in Egypt, the sun was very important in their gods, the god Ra. And so is another warning not to worship these foreign gods. There's stories and writings. The Code of Hammurabi was a very old code of law. Anyone heard of the Code of Hammurabi recently? In Iraq, when they're writing this new constitution, the Code of Hammurabi has come up. They're very proud of this old code and bringing it into their constitution. And what I found to be very interesting is that the epilogue for the Code of Hammurabi, which was written in 1728 to 1686 BCE, so it is probably the oldest written code of law. The epilogue is that the strong may not oppress the weak to give justice to the orphan and the widow. Mm-hmm. It sounds fairly Old Testament, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And New Testament, for that matter. And there were 282 laws that governed social and economic relations and transactions. So, and there's a huge stone with the laws written on it that still stands. And another law that is interesting, I think, in our biblical stories is that a slave could bear a son for a barren wife. So that becomes an important part of the Abraham story, that Hagar would have a child for Sarah. That was part of the law of the Code of Hammurabi. So, and there are these laws in the Exodus and Leviticus laws and things, but it isn't like it's an exact copy, but you can see some parallels at least. Creation stories there are many creation stories from Egypt and Samaria. I don't know so much about Canaanite creation stories. There probably are some, I'm just not too familiar with them. One thing that's true of all of these stories is that it was a supernatural being that brought the world into being. That's a pretty consistent. And there was usually some kind of battle between the gods that then the earth was created. And one Sumerian Babylonian story is Marduk and Tiamat. And it's quite long, but in the end, Marduk overpowers the Tiamat. Marduk was sort of the chief god of the time. Tiamat was the primeval mother, and Marduk kills Tiamat, cuts her in half, and the top half becomes the canopy of the heavens, and the other half becomes under the earth, and then the earth is in the middle. And so you have the above and the below, or the on high and the below. And the below is where you go when you die. It's comparable to Sheol in biblical stories. But
I love the creation of a human story from the Sumerians, and it was, he had a lot of gods in their world, and you had important gods, and then you had worker gods, and the worker gods were becoming rebellious and weren't doing the work the way they were supposed to, so the more important gods decided they had to have some workers that would be a little more dependable and that would not be immortal, because these rebellious gods just hung on forever. So they took some clay, and they took the breath of Wi, which was another god, and had Wi breathe into the clay and made them living beings. But they just had a little bit of God in them, so when they died, then this little breath of God, this would be just a shadow of immortality that would go to the down under and not cause any trouble because they'd be so far away. And these people, though, were very long-lived. In one story, a king lived for 64,000 years. So the long lifespans in the early part of the Bible is not all that different from those stories. And the Bible certainly doesn't have anybody who lived 64,000 years. But then humans got too noisy, and they were irritating the gods because they were very prolific and there got to be lots of humans, and they were living a long time, so the gods had to try and solve the problem, and so they made them sent illness, and they sent a famine, and finally they sent the flood, so there wouldn't be quite so many people. And then after the flood, which is a common story throughout that part of the world, after the flood, the lifespan got shorter. The some women were infertile, and more infants died. So sort of a change in the plan post-flood story. Another story from Sumeria, Babylonia, is Gilgamesh. Familiar with the Gilgamesh story? It's quite long and has a number of parts to it, but one that I find interesting in the context of our tradition is Gilgamesh was searching for eternal life, because humans have lost they were not immortal, and so Gilgamesh was going to search for the secret of immortality. And he actually went to the bottom of the sea and got this branch that was the tree of life, and he was bringing it back to the humans, but he was very tired and he fell asleep, and a snake came and stole it, and so they didn't get immortality. But so the snake was a symbol of immortality, or that the fact that they could form a circle was an immortal kind of symbol. But also snakes shed their skin, and after they shed their skin, they're new and shiny. And so it seemed that they probably lived forever. They just would get rid of their skin and then live forever. So, in the Egyptian creation stories, there are certainly similarities, but a common theme is the sun, god of the sun, and the god of the sun putting out a tent that covers the earth, and then the sun moves around the across the sky in the day. Questions about some of those stories or comments? Or okay, I think what we'll do is take a look at some passages that you have on your biblical texts on the Egyptian and Babylonian creation narratives. These are stories in the Bible that sound very similar to some of the Egyptian and Sumerian stories. But they're not exactly the same. You see suggestions of the stories, but here are people who took the worldview, took the understanding of people around them, but then modified them to be their story, to make it mesh with their God. So I think it's the same task that we have, to take what we know, what we learn from other aspects of the world, and how does that mesh with our understanding of God and what God expects for us. So take a few minutes, pick one of those, pair up with one or two other people, and pick one of those A, B, C, D, or E from Psalms and Proverbs, and see what, if you see any similarities to some of these Sumerian Egyptian stories, and how are they different? Psalm 104 is very long, very beautiful, but especially verses 2 through 9 on A. Okay. Five to 7 minutes to read them. They're, most of them are not all that long.
Take me some
with this word.
Just
to read it ourselves.
All right.
Well, all of it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
What did you...
Well, I think they take very familiar things that the people experience on a daily basis, like the wind and the and their tents and the mountains and the waters. They take these familiar things and weave them into a story of creation. And I see it as very similar to what other cultures have also done. Mm-hmm. They may not be the same elements, but different ones, but a lot of them in common as well. I think it's important to remember too that when you're dealing with oral tradition, I don't know the dating of these songs, but the Genesis one, mm-hmm. when you're dealing with oral tradition, it had to be very simple and easy to remember. Mm-hmm. And so they're just beautiful stories. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it, anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Psalm 104 is just a beautiful story of creation and the ongoing protection of God as well. Mm-hmm.
How about Psalm 19, 1-6?
Anybody do that?
We looked at that.
Okay.
We also don't think we could tie it to a sort of a creation story. But not so much a creation story as sort of a declaration of this is what God has created. More than the actual act itself of creation, sort of a daily reminder that basically the land and everything that comes from it declares the glory of God. At night, basically the knowledge I thought of as the stars. And I mean, they could see many more stars than we can, and they navigated by them. And my information was in the stars. Mm-hmm. That the sun comes up. They also, I read it as them not believing in a flat earth. The sun comes up, goes all the way around.
Yeah, okay.
It comes in and out of its tent like the bridegroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, the same concept of familiarity. Mm-hmm. And that it makes a complete circuit, and there's no way to get out of the sun in the summer. Yeah. So, but that basically, their mere existence proclaimed the glory of God.
Mm-hmm. So very much tied into the role, the importance of God.
Yeah.
What we caught were the relationships between the Egyptian story, mm-hmm. where the sun is absolutely central, and where there's a tent that is built, just like the image of the tent in the Egyptian story, plus the plural for who speaks their words, meaning plural. Mm-hmm. Their words go out to the end of the earth.
Psalm 74. Anybody read that one?
Yeah, we read that one.
Okay.
Basically, it's the creation story that the earth was created out of seas with monsters and vipers, mm-hmm. and that God created the lambs and tame mm-hmm. seas. And so similar to the Genesis story. Mm-hmm.
And you've got night and day, and it's yours.
And God determined the seasons.
Mm-hmm. Got seasons in there. Mm-hmm. So and you've got this monster idea that gets opened up and makes the earth a little bit like Samaritan's and Samaritan stories.
How about Proverbs 3?
We looked at that one. And again, I think we see in this an understanding of God's hand at work in creation. It uses the language of wisdom, which seems to be at the foundation of the earth. Knowledge and understanding come from wisdom. So wisdom is the foundation. Understanding creates the heavens and so I found that interesting, that whenever you see the word wisdom, that's a kind of an interesting concept. Mm-hmm.
Proverbs 8.
That's basically the creation here. Other than go on to plants and animals, but only
the earth itself.
Basic physical geology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we have different ways here of telling the story, and there might be elements that come from other traditions, but the overwhelming thing in all these stories, I think, is the glory of God, the God created the earth. And it's with whether it was from wisdom or whatever the means, the focus is much more on praise God for this wonderful creation.
It seems in that last Proverbs that a little different concept where humans were created first.
Yeah. And that's a very good lead-in. It's very similar to the Genesis 2 story. Mm-hmm. So let's all take a look
at it. But it doesn't say, in my translation, it doesn't say that the Lord created the humans first. It said, the Lord created me the first of his works. And it could well have been that some kind of that I was given some special status, the first of the works, even though I wasn't necessarily chronologically the first.
So it's the first sequence of his acts of long ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, in this one it says in the beginning.
The first, in the beginning. So this one is interesting.
Before the beginnings of the earth I was created.
Yeah, before all else that he made.
Before all earth, before everything was created.
Yeah.
The first verse is wisdom.
Yeah.
Speaking.
Yeah.
When he had not made earth and fields.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
So let's take a look at that second creation story, Genesis 2, 4, 24. An early Israelite creation narrative. So work in your groups again, and everybody read the same story, and think about what strikes you in this story. What are some... what's the story trying to tell people?
That mankind is the chosen handiwork of the Creator.
Yep, that's a very key part of the story. Why don't we take about 5 minutes or so to read the whole story again and then hang out together and talk to members of your group.
This was an article in a national
So did they bite into it yet?
Yeah, and then
So what were some of the things you noticed as you read this story? Which is a very familiar one. It's not anything that noted particularly. You said that man is very important here. Created first. Just a
But so is place.
Place.
place was important, I think.
Okay, so they described place.
Because they were very specific.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of conjecture just exactly where this is, because the Tigris and the Euphrates, we know where that is, but these other rivers can't quite figure out where they are. But you were reading something of the National Geographic, or
National Enquirer. They were talking about accidentally stumbling across the Garden of Eden buried beneath the sands and, looking for weapons of mass destruction. There was obviously completely fabricated, but it only made a cover story out of it.
There was a book when I was a kid that it's in Wabasha, Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, that probably is pretty close.
Yeah. Right off the Pinch Shop River.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a Gihon Spring in Jerusalem.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that? What was that?
There's a Gihon Spring in Jerusalem.
Oh.
We were saying that it's also a very agrarian story.
Mm-hmm.
Very what?
Agrarian
story.
When they're setting the time, as they talk about it in terms of the fields, like things hadn't been planted yet, they hadn't sprung up, and then mm-hmm. actually the god is a gardener, plants a garden and then brings the,
mm-hmm.
the soil to there.
It's a very agrarian story, yeah. And and there's no rain, so things haven't grown yet. And you notice that the rain doesn't fall from the heavens, it comes up from the ground. And there wasn't a lot of rain in Palestine, and maybe they're remembering back to the when they were part of the Tigris and Euphrates, one thing where the water was flowing freely.
Or irrigation.
And yeah. Irrigation, yeah.
I lived longer in valleys.
But mm-hmm. if you've been there, the dew is a really critical part of irrigation, so I think that's what they're referring to.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's a good point.
It really comes up out of the ground.
Yeah.
Comes up out of the ground. Yeah. Or it certainly seems that way. Oh, that's
thanks.
I think, in Genesis 1, it's a descriptive sort of thing, first day, mm-hmm. put this there, and it was evening, and it was morning, and so on. This is a meaning chapter. All the stuff sort of gets reviewed again. Mm-hmm. God created all of this, but in the middle of it, here we are. And the tree of life and the knowledge of good and evil, this is a meaning thing of who are we and why are we here in the midst of all of this.
Someone mentioned wisdom earlier. We're mm-hmm. talking about the other. And that's what struck me with the whole tree of knowledge, good and evil. But this is the one piece of wisdom or the powerful knowledge you can't have. You're denied this since you're not gods. Because it seemed like they were equating the wisdom with God. And then by being deprived of this, this sort of just defines your mortality. Although they were immortal, I guess, at that point. A bit of a stretch.
So that this knowledge of good and evil is that there's a limit to how much humans are going to know. Yes.
It really struck me how different what God says to the person is in this story compared to the first one, mm-hmm. because in the first one. There's the, not that we're necessarily comparing the first and second, but in the second story, God says to till and to keep the garden. And to till and to keep has a very different feel to me than to fill and subdue the earth and have dominion over it. So that says something about the kind of, I don't know what it says. It says something about the kind of intention for what humans do. And maybe the sort of people and the sort of power they thought they had that mm-hmm. the story was written for or from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's before sin. Work, the command to work, to do something came before the fall. So it's not just a result of the fall that they had to do something.
Humans had a job to do, and a big job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was curious from the surgical image of God removing the rib, were they doing different types of surgeries like that?
I don't know how early, but I know that they did cataract surgery fairly. There are records of using tools to pull out the lens fairly early. I don't know if they saw any better afterwards. But so there certainly was surgery done, but I don't. I certainly don't know how early they were cutting people open.
Why the rib? Any beliefs about what ribs were like? They had some special meaning and understanding of the human body at that point?
That's a good, I've never heard that, but maybe that the breathing, that was
heart
a sign of living.
I think the breathing, I think the wind,
I think
the pneuma, more like the spirit.
It was interesting in the sequence that God only told Adam not to eat the apple, not Eve.
Yeah, okay. So maybe Eve never got the message.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. She got the blame, but she didn't get the message.
I always just thought it was a rib because the 12th rib is short, doesn't really come around.
Oh.
And that the Egyptians had a great concept of anatomy. They're always putting people up to mummify them and put their organs in little jars. But I mean, that was just my spin on it. Is that the 12th rib is, you know, anywhere from an inch to a couple inches long.
Yeah, it's
long.
Not so long.
It's like someone took a piece of it, where's the rest of the rib?
Yeah. Women don't have the same number of ribs that men do.
Yeah, they do.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all have the same.
The right side.
Yeah. The bottom ones get pretty short. But, and sometimes in history, women have had their bottom ribs removed so that they can have a smaller waist, because you can pull the waist in further. Mm-hmm. So,
it doesn't hurt to have a rib removed.
Oh, you can get along just fine without it. Someone noted this morning that the human was formed out of clay, and then the breath of God breathed into them, very similar to that Sumerian story. But God forms the animals out of the clay, but he didn't breathe into them. So that, what do you think that's saying? Anything? Or?
I don't know, but the spirit, sorry about bringing up the first chapter, but the spirit moves over the waters, the breath.
Breath, yeah.
Which is what it means, and breathed in the same word as in the New Testament with Jesus at Pentecost is the breath, which would be the presence of God,
or like the soul,
invisible spirit kind of thing. That.
But why the animals didn't get it, I don't know.
I know.
Is that why they believe that animals don't have souls?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, does that connect with the fact that they never believed animals had souls, and we don't either?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that might have something to do with that, I don't know. But I had never really noticed that particular thing until someone pointed it out this morning. The animals didn't get any spirit.
Well, maybe that's our analytical way of having to look at things from the 21st century way of looking at things. And they didn't bother about that detail.
Maybe
not.
Typo.
Yeah, I think so.
It's very hard to book.
No, the committee did it. Accidentally hit the delete button.
Well, I think sometimes parts of this story are pointed out as being too human-centered, so we have authority over animals and authority over the earth, and that we misuse it. Does this story bring that to mind to you? Or what does it have to say to us today?
To me, it's not the authority given to us. It's a stewardship thing. It's we work for the master to care for the earth. And to when it talks about subduing it and all that stuff, I still think it is the concept of caring for it, not ownership.
I mean, it's pretty clear that we are given responsibility. I don't know how much dominion we're given there, but we're certainly given responsibility to till it, care for it.
We get to.
We get to, yeah.
We don't have to, we get to. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Will say that the fact that we name the animals is a symbol of power, dominion over the animals. I like that. You're right.
Relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's like share power, because in the ancient world to have know someone's name was to, depending on how you use it, was to share power with that person, to have a relationship that exchanged mutual benefit.
Mm-hmm. I certainly like that interpretation a lot better, that knowing a name is a symbol of relationship, not of power over.
Yes. You name your children.
Yeah,
yeah, you
do. You name your children, and mm-hmm. you have both responsibility and.
Absolutely, no power over them.
Yeah. But you have the illusion of power.
They have a relational story that happened telling this very story to some preschool kids. Mm-hmm. And we talked about it, naming all the animals and stuff. And then here comes this woman. And I just asked the kids, what do you think Adam called this woman, his wife? And one of the kids says, honey. That's relational.
That's relational. One thing that I've thought of when I read this story, and it seems as though, you know, humans are given a responsibility and a very special place in creation. And if I can attempt to imagine myself as a nomadic person in coming into Canaan or wherever it is that I'm living, to imagine that I would be important enough that God would give me the job of tilling the earth and caring for the earth seems to me very empowering. Because I would think that as a small clan of nomads, you felt pretty vulnerable. You're traveling around, you're in a desert situation where there's not a lot of water, you're looking for food, you're attempting to grow food if you're a farmer, that this story gives you a sense of how important I am and how maybe not so vulnerable because I have this wonderful God who is providing for me. I don't know if that's a helpful image for anyone else, but if I put myself on feeling very vulnerable, somehow this is encouraging to me, that a God made me, a God cares for me, made the animals, and I'm important enough that I'm supposed to take care of it. Maybe a little overwhelming too, as well. Someone pointed out this morning that in the up until the flood, there's no talk about eating animals. It's only eating green things. If you read the story that you provided, plants for feeding humans and plants for feeding all the animals as well. And when I suggested this morning that maybe you felt vulnerable because of the animals, somebody said, but the animals weren't eating anything but grass, so you didn't have to be too afraid of the animals. And then after the flood, then people eat meat. I don't know if animals ever didn't eat each other, but in this story, they certainly do not. But that's probably not the point of this story. The point is that animals are made by God. But another important aspect of this story is that there's a different relationship between humans and animals, and between humans and other humans. We are created for relationship, and relationship with someone like us.
On that note, I haven't really noticed it as clearly as it seems true to me reading it this time, but it really doesn't emphasize procreation at all. It focuses on this relationality and not being alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing about going forth and multiplying.
No, there's no multiplying in this story.
Cleaving, but no multiplying.
That's right. That is true. It's about very strongly about relationship, not as opposed to procreation. I think that's the beauty of taking a fresh look at stories. You see something you might not have seen before, and have other people looking at those stories. You have different insights, and that we have more than one creation story in the Bible. It gives us another way of looking at God's handiwork. That it isn't just this is the way it is, and you never have to think about it again. But we have some beautiful treasures in the Bible, and it's fun to look at them from some different perspectives. But,
On a scientific basis, could Adam be defined as the first biologist? His job was to identify and categorize all the flora.
I think he was the first taxonomist.
I mean, he had to identify, mm-hmm. categorize things, give them all names.
Okay. And he saw differences. He was a good observer. It's a characteristic of human beings to observe.
But I think the naming had to do with identity, like Nancy was talking about, and giving identity, or giving the status of identity, or giving the the status of separate createdness is part of the naming function, it seems to me here. But I think that's really an important observation, that business about the relationship of man to the animals, that man had that responsibility for giving identity to the animals, and in that had a responsibility for that.
I think of when I was in studying in Jerusalem with a Hebrew professor and talked about the creation story, and then talking really about the genesis of this story, was really a children asking, where did we come from? Mm-hmm. And it was your old rabbis that really then made up this story that talked about, okay, their sense of a nation set apart, to your point, that we were created specially. But it's really a human construct of, we kind of sort of think that there's this ordained thing here, but it's a human construct of what they thought it was, and probably telling their children when it first started, well, where did we begin? And for me, that was a really interesting way to start thinking about all this stuff, and you know, the rabbis still debate to this day these very issues in terms of what they really meant when somebody first made this thing up. Because it's really quite weird in some respects. The whole thing is a little outlandish.
Most of the creation stories we've been talking about they're all pretty bizarre.
I think in some ways you begin with the second story, which is more agrarian and which is more story-based. And out of that, you begin to say, okay, what's the meaning then for a culture as the culture becomes more sophisticated, as we're no longer agrarian? Mm-hmm. And I think Genesis 1 then becomes something that is more intentional and is really a kind of a liturgical fragment from a later period that is prepared for use liturgically. It ends with Shabbat.
Yeah.
See, there is a reason for Shabbat. Mm-hmm. This is the order of creation, and it goes like this, and it's kind of like a litany that can be used in worship.
Yeah. And we'll look at that story a little bit tomorrow. But I think it is a way to explain why the world is the way it is.
It's a weird
And so. And every culture does it. I mean, it's part of being human, I think, to try to figure out why you're here. And we have to ask those same questions today. And we probably aren't here to till the garden in the exact same way, but we certainly have a lot of the earth that needs our care. And we aren't always doing such a good job. And I think you're very conscious of care of the earth when you're here at Holden, because you're so much in the midst of beauty, but you're also, when you hear the fire alarm, you're very aware of the vulnerability that you have, and the need to be prepared to care for this part of the earth that's been entrusted to us.
How does this speak to a software engineer in Redmond, Washington, who lives inside a big cubicle and computer? I mean, other than the wisdom and knowledge. It's hard to tie this agrarian story to as he mentioned, our advanced or technical society.
Mm-hmm. And how does it compare with, say, the Peruvian story of creation?
Peruvian story.
In Peru.
Oh, tell us more about that.
I don't know a lot about it, but it doesn't follow creation of man and woman or Adam and Eve. Or the fall of man, as this does now. Of course, this was carried on, but that even was at the same time or a similar time of the world, that they came at least broke down in their one with their alphabet. They used threads. They used an almost a crocheting thing to tell their story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about that.
True, false, bad, good. How do we know? They use beads and thread.
As memory tools for their story?
As alphabet tools, yes.
I think the software engineer issue is a really interesting one, because for me at least, what this tells me or reminds me is that I didn't create myself. And sometimes when you're just sitting at your cubicle creating code, you could get yourself into the belief that you somehow were just a part of that process of just diddling around with stuff and it came about. And what this suggests to me is a different idea about how I got here, how that I really wasn't in charge of that process. And so I think that it's a very ancient story, but it's a very present story because of that character to it. And I remember having this conversation with Peter Senge. He said we were talking about the sort of the idea of creating a vision for the future or a sense about what you wanted. And he said the most important thing, this was in conjunction with developing a sense of personal mastery, and he said the most important question was, what do you want? And I said, geez, Peter, that doesn't do it. I mean, I don't come to those wants decontextualized. And he said, what? And I said, well, you know, I actually believe I'm created and interdependent and that I, in fact, was given a bunch of gifts. And so it's in that context that I have to ask this question, what do I want? I mean, this business of personal mastery, separate from the context of these other essential parts of this creation story, doesn't really do it for personal mastery today. So I mean, that for me is the connection to the Redmond, Washington software engineer.
That's interesting, Paul, because when we were in Senegal 7-8 years ago, I don't remember, we were in a small village where it was a lot of Muslim around there, but this was not. And there was a storyteller in the village. And the storyteller did not come from the upper class. The storyteller was way down at the bottom, which was interesting that that would be the person to collect the story and make sure it's preserved and passed on. Then maybe the rabbi types come along and systematize it so that the second chapter could be the storyteller type. You know, he's got this guy, he got all these people, they need names, and this is how it happened. And the first chapter, then rabbis or whatever come along and systematically say, no, and it was evening and it was morning and this happened, you know, did the Redmond routine.
So we all have our part in the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the Navajo have tremendous stories on creation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we do. Every culture does. Well, I guess our time is up, but thank you very much for coming today.
Tomorrow?
And tomorrow we are going to talk about Babylonia. Here. We're going to talk about Babylonia.